We are in the book of Genesis, I believe, right? Okay, 8th chapter. So I'd like to have a reader on the 8th chapter.
But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed. The rain from the heavens was restrained, and the waters receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the waters had abated, and in the 7th month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat, and the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the 1st day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent forth a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him in the ark. For the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth a dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. Then he waited another 7 days and sent forth a dove, and she did not return to him any more. In the 601st year, in the 1st month, in the 1st day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the 2nd month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Then God said to Noah, "Go out of the ark, and you and your wife, and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth, went out by families from the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of the every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, "I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease."
Interesting chapter. Yes, it is. Any comments?
When I was going to synagogue down when I was going to college, one of the guys had asked at the time, which they of course go through this cycle every year, said, "It doesn't make sense as to why Noah, after taking the 7 pairs of clean animals, wouldn't choose which one to kill. God spent all this time and effort to preserve all these. He probably chose a male, but they just wiped out 1/7 of the potential repopulation lines from the male lines, at least.
Okay.
Why would God be pleased with Noah killing what God spent all this effort trying to preserve?
Okay. Interesting thought. I didn't think about that one. Sean?
I was just looking at some of the specifics here. 7th day and the 2nd month. I mean, there's something here I'm curious to know about.
Yeah, a lot of 7s in this particular chapter. A lot of 7s in this particular chapter.
Verse 13, where he says exactly 601 year in the 1st month.
Is that how old he was, yeah.
Okay.
How old Noah was.
That was how old. Oh.
That either means he was within that year or approaching that year. When no one saw how you want to look at things and how you want to count things. All right. Oh.
I think one quick point that people should kind of click on here a little bit. Sean hints at it, but there are so many dates or anniversaries here, if you will, that it just is common sense to me that this is a historical document. You have so many people that will say that everything before Abraham is allegorical and blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
But with these specific dates, that on this particular date, this thing happened. On this particular date, this thing happened. This is a historical document.
Right. And the second month is a very historical date or period of time, repeated quite often in Genesis. Quite fascinating to think about the second month. We always think, oh, the first month is more important. Well, to a degree, but the second month, it seems that God uses it quite often. We'll get to that a little bit today. I just find it kind of fascinating. I don't have an answer to everything, so I'm ready for you to give me the answer. Are you ready to give me the answer? All right. Well, I'll start with the very first verse here, right of hand. There are just three words I want to kind of look at. You know, the word says, and Elohim remembered. You know, it's like he forgot. Well, in Hebrew, that word is kind of remembrance, but not like we would think we lost a memory. There are things in your life that you do for that happens, so that when you walk or you come to that point, it triggers your actions to do something. All right. In Hebrew, this word really comes down to an old-fashioned word meaning it's either a mark or recognized a symbol or recognized of something that has to be done. So he was didn't say he forgot him. He was actually looking upon him and saying, and then like it says in the 9th chapter, verse 15, and I will remember my covenant. Like he forgot it? No. I will mark my covenant, which is between me and you and to every living creature. So basically the word, we look at this one, it says, and God marked, marked Noah and every living creature that was on earth. Those are the ones that he saved. So he put a mark on him. In that sense, when we look at the Hebrew phrase of the word mark, here for the word remembrance. And it's an old word, but it means remembering in the Bible is not a recollection Bible. It's not a book of recollection. It's a focusing upon an object of a memory that results in actions. Now when Tammy said this is very historical points within it. They're marking a point in time and history. Marking a point, time and history. And the very same thing of the holidays, it's a marking of a point. And when God says to remember the Sabbath day, means to mark the Sabbath day. The Sabbath day winds up being a mark. Something for you, always have something that brings you back to not remembrance, but puts you into action to do something. So basically, that's basically what the basic word means in a sense. And Elohim acts upon what he has stated in the past. In the past he stated, I am going to make a covenant with you, Noah, before the flood. Now he's bringing that covenant to reality after the flood. So we have to kind of remember, like he did with Abraham. He remembered the covenant with Abraham. Now he marked the covenant with Abraham, that he knows what it's all about, and that mark is really evidence not for God alone, if I can use that word alone, but also for us to pay close attention to what he said and what he put a remembrance upon. It's like God created the seventh day, but he said for you to remember it, for you to mark it in your life, mark it on your time. Make sure you will always, when it comes around, it's a memorial in a sense. To my creation of man, of the world and mankind. Of course, the other one is the word wind. It really means what it says. The wind can mean a lot of different things. Like ruach is the actual word we use to think mean spirit. But and when we use the word spirit in our own language, as you'll find throughout the entire Tanakh, and even in the New Testament, I can't remember right off hand the word they use for spirit there. But nonetheless, it also has a meaning of breath or wind. Okay, same meaning. And there are times in Ecclesiastes it says that the wind is like traveling. If you're chasing after the wind, like vanity, going after the wind, you can't grab it. You can't hang on to it. You can't control it. It's of and by itself. And this particular wind was passed over. And it says that the waters were assuaged. That's an interesting phrase, don't you think? Waters were assuaged. I read in Old English, and the word assuaged is very interesting terminology. Okay? What do you think the word assuage refers to? Something has been done. It says, now, there was a result of the wind at Noah's time. What was the wind's function? It was the waters assuaged and the wind relieved. This is the assuage means. The wind relieved something unpleasant. Now, the wind also can not assuage. It can actually bring in something that's not pleasant, like the flood itself. But here is a kind of interesting terminology of that the window, not the window, we're not in the word window yet, but in the ways of the waters assuaged, it means that the wind actually relieved something. Assuaged means that something has been relieved. Something has been, the bad news is starting to be changed now. Very fascinating terminology. And the second verse, I want to read, go through that just a little more. I find it very fascinating here. It says there's three things listed in verse 2. So we're going to go through these three things because I think it helps us to understand how the Hebrew is trying to tell us the part that is referring to. We just kind of read it in English. Yeah, okay, we got the picture. But there's something a little bit deeper in many of these things that we're going to see in the 8th chapter, I hope. He says there, and the fountains also of the deep, the windows of heaven stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. There's three things there. The fountains of the deep, the windows of heaven, and rain from heaven. You notice three different things? Did you notice that before? Now, it's a very unusual phrase to in the English language. We'll talk about this. In this chapter, there are two words that have been translated as the word window. But this particular beginning, it's the first time the word window in the text is used here. It's in the 8th chapter. And it's not like what you think it means. It's not something that you open up and see. It's not a window that of opportunity. It's not a window that allows sunlight to come in. It's a different kind of window. In Hebrew, I think it's very important to know this because we'll go through some scriptures here about the windows. We have something we need. Now, we basically understand the fountains of the deep. That means basically the water from the earth has now opened up. You know, and the scripture says the water returned. Well, it had to return back to the very place it opened up to. Under the fountains. So the fountains were gushed open. Where did the water go from there? After it started receding from the earth, it had to go back into the fountains of the earth, or fountains of the deep. So it's kind of fascinating. There's more fresh water under earth than there is in top water. A lot more fresh water. It's not what California would authorize you to drink, but that's another point. So the word window, it's aruba. Aruba. And it's not what you might think. The ruba is like how can I explain this? Best way I can describe it is it's like you have a window, a real window, but you have blinds on it. And the blinds block something. Or prevent something from being seen. It's more like a lattice or a layer of, on top of one another, and you can't see through it. And the windows of heaven means that something was being held back. And when the windows of heaven opened up, or the lattices opened up, the vines opened, the veneer opened up, down came the rain. Down came the water, it was even higher than it was in the heavens. Or the higher that was even on the earth. There's the heavens that's in the earth, and there's the heaven that's above. There's two different ones. There's rain from the heaven, means the heaven that in Genesis chapter 1 talks about the heaven, which he separated the waters, and he put in there the water above the earth and water beneath the earth. In this particular case, he opened up the fountains that were where the shades or the lattices were closed. And you can't see the lattices. I cannot see lattices. I'll just prove you here in a minute a few fascinating terminology. To explain a little bit things about the lattice, in the seventh chapter we read earlier, and he says, the windows were opened up. And he says, on the 600th year of Noah, it's the second month, the second month, the 17th day of the month, same day that where the fountains of the deep were great opened, and the windows of heaven were opened. That means they were closed at one time. So lattices, this is not the window we think of, open up our window so we can see outside, let air come in. It's not that kind of a window. It was a lattice or overlapping things that you cannot see. So dark you wouldn't see it. And they opened up, down came the water. Now, just to give you an example, I'm going to read in 2 Kings about the windows. 2 Kings, with the same phrase of the windows of heaven is used, meaning the very same Hebrew word, the Urubah. 2 Kings, chapter 7. Now, Dan's going to be going through this much later. I know that, and in this particular chapter, it's one of those things that's got to be one of those, he starts here, and goes at the bottom where he's going to be dead center. What's talking about? I just know the way it's written is very fascinating. But I'm not going to read the whole thing. Seventh chapter, starting verse 1. Elijah, the most famous man in the history of the Bible, said, hear the word of Yahuwah. Thus says Yahuwah, tomorrow, about this time, a measure of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, at the gates of Samaria. So now we're in a different country, right? We're in the land of Israel, and the king was living, the king of northern Israel was living in Samaria. So we kind of know a location where we're at. We're not in Jerusalem, we're not right there. And he said, now verse 2, so an officer, don't know who it was, on whose hand the king learned, or whatever he learned from this officer transformed that information to the king, and learned and answered the man of Elohim, meaning Elijah, and said, look, very interesting statement here now. If Yahuwah would make windows of heaven, could this thing be? And then, in fact, this the man or Elijah said, in fact, you shall see it with your eyes, but you shall not eat of it. Now, we're talking of windows of heaven, right? Something that is being held back. It's not opened up yet. Now, as we read this story, we go on. What there was, Syria was at war. And they were coming to battle and going against northern Israel. And Samaria was in a point of starvation. They starved them out. They wouldn't let food come in or go out. So it was a period of time that's been going on, and their point of literally dying. And their 4 lepers were at the entrance of the gate. They weren't in the gate. They had to be at the entrance of the gate. They're not allowed to go into Samaria. And they said to one another, why are we sitting here until we die? Really interesting question, right? And he says, okay, now, verse 4, if we say we will enter the city, the famine is in the city, and we will die. And if we sit here, we'll also die. Now, therefore, come, let us surrender to the army of Assyria, that if they keep us alive, we shall live. If not, we die. And that was our option. A very interesting approach. Now, in order to read the story real rapid, real quick forward, the men went into the land of where the camp of Syria was, and there was no one there. Everybody ran for their life. But they left behind everything. They left behind their weapons, they left behind their horses, left behind their donkeys, left behind their food, left behind their camp, left everything and just took off. Well, these 4 men, guess what they did? They sat down and they got something to eat. And they felt guilty about it. You know, so we shouldn't be doing this. We should go tell the king, right? And so now there's an abundance of food. Right? So at first the king said no. And then after a while, his advisor said, let's go look at it, to see if the guys were really talking. I mean, who believes a leper, right? Anyway, it's very fascinating. And so verse 13, it says, and his servants answered to the king. It says, please send several men, take five of the remaining horses that are left in the city. Look, that they may enter in and become like the multitude of Israel that is left in it. Or indeed, I say, they may become like the multitude of Israel left from those who are consumed. So let us send them and see. And the king says, okay, go and see. Go take a look. As the story progressed, and it happened, and let's drop on down to verse 18. And so it happened, just as the man of Elohim, meaning Elijah, has spoken to the king, saying, two measures of barley for a shekel, a measure of fine flour for a shekel, shall be sold tomorrow about this time in the gate of Samaria. Remember he said that in the very first part of the chapter? Now it's repeated in the very last part of the chapter. And what did the man at the gate say? What did the man at the gate say? It's repeated right here. And he said, verse 19, now look, same exact words. Yahuwah would make windows of heaven. Could such a thing be? Now the lattices of opening up the windows of heaven, the lattices of heaven. Now, did anything come down? What came down? Food. Oh, they're not starving anymore. And the price is good price, the right price. We can afford this. All right. And of course, the man, and then Elijah said something back to him. In fact, you shall see it with your eyes, but you shall not eat of it. What happened? And so what happened to him? The people trampled him at the gate, and he died. Now that's a picture or story of a window in heaven, of the windows of heaven opening up. Unseen, unaware, you don't know it. We have a prophet named Elijah, says, on this time tomorrow, you will see the food. The food will be there. And the man at the gate says, windows from heaven? I make a mockery. And so what happened? Yeah, you'll see it, he said, but you won't eat it. All of a sudden, Samaria survived. So we look at the thing about the windows, or lattices, if I call it, or crisscrossers, something that comes down. And in Malachi 3, verse 10, you don't have to turn there, just write it down. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that ye may be that there may be meat in my house. And prove me not herewith, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open the windows of heaven. So when we think about, so what is the windows of heaven holding? In the time of Noah, what was the windows of heaven holding back? Water. Destruction. From above. That is from the very throne of God. Destroying everything in the face of the earth. Now we read the windows are closed. And now the windows, the rain of heaven stopped. And now the fountains of the earth closed. So that phrase, windows from heaven, in this particular Greek, means something has been revealed that was held back. Now, when Noah entered the ark, he was revealed what the windows of heaven was going to do. So when you think about the lattices or that the decision, even in modern 20th century, when you ask for God, for the tithing come down, he says, the windows of heaven will open up to you. See if I'll bless you. Blessings that come to abundance to you, you don't see it. Right? And when you do something, then the windows of heaven open up to you. So it can be a blessing or a cursing. Depends upon how you want to look at it. So it's not really physically telling us that all the water came down, but the word of the third of God itself is doing and acting and instituting the whole thing. You understand what I'm saying? God is acting on it and is doing the whole job. So he's telling us the first thing was what's happened when he closed those windows. Now there's protection. What happened? Well, the water had to be subsided and taken away. Now, go back to Genesis. Chapter 8. And the ark rested on the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the Mount of Ararat, on the mountains of Ararat. Now, we know those are the days of what we call Sukkot, days of the tabernacles. So, in a sense, on the third day, something happened. What happened on the third day? Something came to a rest. What came to a rest? The ark. Now remember, how high was the ark? 45 feet. So half of it was still in the water before it was lifted up off the ground. Remember that? Now, on this particular date, the third day, now it's resting, but it's still in the water. All it says, it's not moving anymore. It's on stable ground. So God put him on a stable ground. Now, if you were Noah, what were you thinking? What would you think if you were Noah? It's stopping. Oh, it's stopping. Oh, we're at rest now. It's a play on his own name. Remember? A play on his own name. I like that story. And the waters continued to recede until the tenth month. In the tenth month, on the first day of the month, were the tops of the mountains seen. Now remember, the ark was still resting. So from the seventh month to the tenth month, the ark was still in the water. Now the tops of the mountains are seen. So it's dropped down now, probably below the level of the ark itself. Didn't tell you how low, but nothing done low enough that he could see the tops of the mountains. Remember, he rested. There were no tops of mountains there. He couldn't see any mountains whatsoever. He must have been very, very high. Or how God moved the fountains and moved the water, we don't know. Where the water went in different directions, how water goes to its lowest point, not its highest point. Anyway, so we hear that it continued until the seventh day. Now it seems to be at the harvest time, I said, during the third season, and which continues the 17th day of that month. The ark rested on the 17th day. And why on the 10th day? On the 10th month, the top of the mountains were seen. Now, here's one thing Tammy brought up. Now, that's a certain date on memorial time, a time of remembrance. It's very important. I don't have an answer what the 10th of the month means at all. I'll be honest with you. I would like to know, and if you have answers for me, so I told you, you got answers for that? Okay, let's go on this. And it came to time, now remember, he saw something, he saw the tops of the mountains. Now, verse 6, and it came to pass at the end of 40 days, what did Noah do? He opened the window. Now, it's a different word in Hebrew. Not the one we talked about earlier. Not lattice. Actually, it's a window. Yes?
First day of the 10th month is the 6th day of Hanukkah.
That's a what now?
The 6th day of Hanukkah.
And on the 10th day? First day of the 10th month?
The first day of the 25th day of the 9th month. It's the first day of Hanukkah. Hanukkah lasts 8 days. So the first day, it may be 6th day, it might be 5th or 6th, someone in that ballpark. Okay. That would be the 5th or 6th day of Hanukkah. So that is it's Hanukkah. It's when that happens, middle of it.
The only thing, that sounds great. The only thing I have a question about, though, because during Noah's time, there's no such thing as a longer day and not 10 minutes recession. So due date, what was their months made up of? 29 days? 30 days? That's why that's one of those questions I don't have the background. I don't know.
Fortunately, it doesn't really matter because
doesn't really matter.
You could argue whether it's only a 28-day-long month or a 29-day-long month.
Yeah.
So you could be 5th or the 6th, whatever.
It's
either the 5th or the 6th day of Hanukkah, depending on how long the month happened to
have
been.
Can I play your pen? Thank you. He said yes. Oh. Okay. Hanukkah. The fifth day of Hanukkah.
Fifth or sixth.
Okay. Thank you for loaning your pen.
I'm glad you heard me.
Yes, Ellie.
If that count, it's probably the middle of Hanukkah, which is Conception Day, which is the the midpoint.
That's kind of interesting. I need some answers. Maybe that's going to be have to look at it from that point of view. It'd be fascinating. That was told way back in advance before the first day of Hanukkah showed up in the history. Fascinating. So anyway, from that point in time, 40 days later, what did he do? He opened up the window. No, actually, he opened the window on the ark. That's when you see daylight through, see lights coming through. It really means in Hebrew, meaning noontime. Literally, when it says he opened the window, it says at noon, thou shalt make an ark. It's kind of an odd statement, though he made a window or for him to open up for at noontime, and he opened it up at noontime. Very fascinating terminology from chapter 6, verse 16, to this one of chapter 6, verse 8. Same phrase being used. It really means noon or high noon. Funny terminology. Now, verse 7, I'm going to ask you some questions. It's fascinating. I think it's very fascinating. What did Noah do? Why did he send a raven for? Was it a mistake?
No.
What?
It's a scavenger bird.
Really?
The ravens are.
Really? Is that what this book, this what says this? Is this telling us, and the raven went out and fed himself. That's not what it says. It said, this Hebrew phrase is very important here. To and from. What does that mean in English? Okay, in Hebrew, it means he went out and he returned. He went out and he returned. He went out and returned. The raven, there's nothing there for the raven. Now the question is, why a raven? Why did he send the raven first? Why did he send an eagle? That's also a scavenger. Why didn't he send some parrot? Why did he send some other animal? Why a raven? Now, God had that for a purpose, and he, Noah, knew to send the raven out. No other bird. Don't send the dove out. Send the raven out. And the raven would go out of the ark and come back into the ark. The raven would go out of the ark and come back into the ark. No place for him to rest either. We think, but the dead body's all the place. And we interpret because he's a scavenger. That's not what it says. Yes?
Well, I was just looking up here. I'm cheating. It says, to become evening, to grow dark, from evening to evening. So is it to mark the time, the day? From evening
to listen
evening?
To the latter part of this verse. He kept going back out and come back in. Go back out, come back in. Until the waters were dried up from the earth. That's a long time between verse 7 and the time the land was dry. So don't put this raven as some kind of scavenger. Okay, he sent it out for a reason. Has to do with the name raven. What does it mean? What is the Hebrew word for raven? Orev. Arev. Comes from the verb. Comes from a verb, remember? Verb base. Tells you something about why Noah set it out. The Hebrew, the verb is Arav. To grow duskly at sunset. Oh. What does that tell you? What would that tell Noah as he sent this raven out and it kept going back and forth, back and kept traveling back and forth until the ground was dry? What was it telling Noah? It wasn't time. Marking time. Right, he records the time.
Now, go back and forth from sunset to sunset to mark the time.
Sunset. We're at sunset to sunset, basically. From sunset to sunset. The raven will come back at sunset. What was it telling Noah? What was the raven revealing to Noah without speaking to him? There is no dry land. Period. Simple as that. No dry land. Yeah, but the mountains up there, no dry land. No dry land. And the raven kept going back and both back, even after the dove went out. Three times. The raven still was going back and forth, because no dry land. Did you notice that, what it says? So the raven was very important to let Noah know something. The dry land. The raven stopped coming back when there was dry land. We'll get to that point. Just keep those thoughts in mind. We sometimes put a negative slant to a bird that God created to tell Noah, don't go out until the land is dry. And there's only one bird he sent out to find out if the land was dry. So the raven was a positive thing, not a negative thing. Right? It was telling Noah, keep hope, the land will go away, the water 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 will go away. You understand what I'm saying so far? Going to and fro. Now, he also, verse 8, set forth, yes.
You mentioned that he went out three times. I'm trying to see where that is.
I'm sorry, where?
You said that the raven went out three times? Where?
No, the dove.
Oh, the dove, okay.
In a period of 7 days. Not periods, but every on the seventh day. More than likely on the Sabbath itself. That's my thinking. It may be worthless. Doesn't make a difference. And he sent forth, he also sent forth a dove from him. Now, here the raven goes out. He also sent forth a dove. Now, we have in our mind, he didn't send the dove out until after the raven didn't return. But now we're reading here what it says. The raven kept going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, in and out, in and out, in and out, until the ground was dry. But the dove was also sent out. But it didn't come back the third time. Right? Didn't that tell you fast anything? Now, it tells us something, too, about the dove. Verse 9. Why he sent forth the dove? To see if the waters were abated from off the face of the ground. They weren't. The raven wasn't going to rest until it had dry ground. But a dove, he sent out to find out if the water is abating, is still there, is still there. When did he send the dove out? My personal opinion, I think he sent it out on the first day of the 10th month, as he did the raven and the dove. Both were sent out on the same day. But the dove came back. Didn't go back in and out and in, like the raven did. It stayed. And it's a play on words here. For the dove found no Noah. For his sole of his feet. And she returned unto him, Noah himself, into the ark, for the waters on the face of the earth the water was still on the face of the earth. Then Noah put out his hand, and he took her and pulled her in unto himself into the ark. That's a powerful statement. What do you think it means? Didn't have to do that, the raven. But why the dove? I'm sorry, what?
She's a weaker bird. She's not as hardy as a raven.
Okay. Wait. We're grant you, the physical will tell us the spiritual. All right. What does this physical tell us about the spiritual thing? What is a dove? Clean bird. Okay. This is one word they have not been able to find out what it means in Hebrew. This is an unknown definition. They don't know. And so they're looking at it from what does a normal bird do? They go to their nest. What do pigeons do?
They mate.
If you put out your hand to... Sorry, what?
The dove mates for life, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When you put out your hand and you have a bunch of doves around or pigeons around, what do? They hop on your hand, they get the food right out of your hand. Then they're free. Oh, you're the one that supplies them something. You're the one that gives them something, right? So a dove is kind of like a pigeon, although we don't like it because they mess all over the place. That's not the point. But, you know, the dove or pigeon, both are interchangeable here in Greek. We use carrier pigeons. What do they carry? Huh? A lot of messages. Why didn't they just fly away? God created them to be an assistance to mankind. So the messages that the dove was sent out to find, the dove could not bring back a message. You understand what I'm saying? If there was a message out there, the bird would have taken the message and brought it back to Noah. Does that make sense to you? Well, so we're talking, this particular bird is an unusual bird. Do hawks do that? The chickens do that. The ostriches do that. They can't even fly. But you understand what I'm saying? The full uniqueness, the most unique birds. I think it's one of the most unique birds that God created. They didn't come evolve into lacking mankind in the very beginning. Noah used that. I need a message, O eternal God. Here's my dove. And the dove didn't land anyplace else except on his arm. No message. And instead of getting rid of the bird, he just brought it into himself. And 7 days later, he sent the dove out again. Now, what did the dove do? It brought back a message. Do you understand what I'm saying here? And that dove, so this is not just a nice, wonderful story. The dove was doing its function that God created it for, and no one knew it. He also knew what the raven's function was for, at going in and out, in and out, in and out, until there was dry ground. He knew what the raven's function was about. It wasn't just a happenstance, I think I'll pick that one. Noah, sent it out. You understand what I'm saying? Yes.
Because if you think about it, the raven was very restless.
Yeah.
He was very restless, you know, coming and going. If Noah had tried to put his arm out and say, hey, come back in here, he probably wouldn't have come.
Would not.
He was just very restless. He wanted to explore and
look around. It's not that bird comes back to mankind. It just lands back in the ark. That's all. Like almost 99% of all birds do. How many birds do you know that's going to run to mankind? Very few. Yes.
I just, it's interesting that the word for dove is Jonah.
Yeah, Jonah.
So Jonah was supposed to carry a message to Nineveh.
Yeah.
And he went through his own
the
situations,
Jonah,
but it's the same word. Yes,
that's his name. And actually, in Hebrew, it's got a male sound to it, but it's kind of fascinating of him by itself. So, do you understand a little bit what I've seen? I hope I see it right. And maybe if not, at least put that in your thoughts of, Oh, that's why the raven was sent out. It was because of this. That's why the dove was sent out. That was because of this. And when Noah sent it out for the third time, no message. You know why? Because Noah didn't need any more. Now the dove goes unto a very special place. Olive tree. He just brought back one leaf. Not a branch, just one leaf. That's all the bird got hold of. I think that really is a warning, a comfort to Noah. But then he didn't leave yet, did he? All I know, the dove was not going to come back. What was that raven doing? Back and forth, back and forth. He's in, he's out, he's in, he's out. And so Noah waited for another 7 days. In Exodus, don't have to turn there, the house of Israel were supposed to do something for the priest. They had to do something with olive, right? And so they were supposed to take the olive, crush it into fine top notch oil, and the people of Israel were to give it to the priest so they can keep the light going constantly. The olive tree is a different terminology. It comes from a word, zayit. It's a very unusual word. That word, zayit, became a name of a month. A ziv. And it's in the Torah. 1 Kings chapter 6. Same basic word, same basic root word. I had to look this up because I got very fascinating. I did this some years ago, and for today, for some reason, it made sense to me. To be honest, truth. Chapter 6, verse 1 of 1 Kings. And it came to pass in the 418th year after the children of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, the month of Ziph, which is the second month, they began to build the house of Yeshua. Second month. Now, it's funny because olive is connected with that word. Second month. Verse 37, same chapter. In the fourth year was the foundation of the house of Yahuwah laid in the month of Ziph. The same word. Fascinating terminology. So we find that in the second month in Noah, in the seventh chapter, 11th chapter, 11th verse in Noah, seventh chapter, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day which the fountains of the earth were great and opened up. Now he sent this bird out, and the bird brought back an olive leaf. Not that it's necessarily the second month. We'll get there in a minute. But the timing is at a point. It's very fascinating here as we watch what we're looking at, and what Sammy was saying. There's something very important with certain dates. And I can go chapter after chapter after chapter where second month is mentioned, second month is mentioned, second month is mentioned, second month is mentioned over and over and over again. I don't have an answer why the second month is spoken up more, perhaps than any other month. But I'm beginning to have the curiosity in my mind. I said, okay, God, you're hammering with this thing. Where do I go from here? I don't know. He may let me know. He may not let me know. That's his choice, not mine. But it's always interesting the second month. Now back to Genesis chapter 8. And even after the bird did not come back, Noah stayed yet another 7 days. So that's 4 7-days. 4 periods of time of 7 weeks or 7 days. 7 day period. 4 7-day periods. He set forth... as we sent forth, you return not. Okay. And it came to the pass after 600 in the first year, in the first month of the first year, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from off the face of the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. Oh, what happened here now? Did you notice that? Came to pass on the first of the month, the first day of the month, what took place? The raven stopped going back and forth. So he opened up the covering of the ark, and behold, it was dry ground. Now once again, verse 14, in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, was the earth completely dried. He still didn't come out. And Elohim told him, okay, on that date, that day, Noah, come on out. You, bring everybody out with you. And all the living things. And so, there they are. They all came out now. Verse 20. The Noah built an altar unto Yahuwah. Now, it took every clean beast and every clean fowl, offered whole offering on the altar. Now, we use the word every in English. Doesn't mean every single one of them. Remember, I told you before. Now, this is my personal belief. When you are to offer anything unto the Creator of heaven and earth, it's not any clean animal, not any clean bird, but a specific cleaned animal and a specific clean bird. What is the one bird? The dove. So he only took one of every clean. Now, there might be another one. We don't know. I haven't found it in Scripture. But we're looking at this thing, and the word every is like saying all. It's like, you know, time when Messiah was at someone's house, and then it says, all of the town was at the door. And no, it wasn't. The word all doesn't mean all in English, nor does it mean all at all in Hebrew, or does it mean all and all in Greek. When you say you're all wet behind the ears, no, mine's dry. And we use the phrases and that, and it's very difficult using phrases. But nonetheless, yes.
Like at the feast over there at the Redwoods. Well, who all was there? Everybody was there.
Yeah. You know, it's like when kids begin to grow up and say, Mom and Dad, everybody does it. And he says, no, not everybody. Let's clarify it. You got three friends that do it. The rest of them don't. I mean, every one of my friends that I want to call friends do it. That's what it boils down to. Anyway, so we see here that he made an offering. Was God upset? Oh, no, not at all. Then there's something that Yahuwah said in what? In his heart. See, he is still seeing the actions of God. God created a dove to tell Noah. Noah knew it. God created a dove for Noah to know to win the message. When he doesn't come back, it's getting, the water's going to be going away. And when the raven, didn't return, the ground was dry. Those are actions of God, not actions of a dove, not the actions of a raven, not the actions of things, but actions of God. That's why I read this book and study the book of Genesis. I see more of God involved in every aspect that ever goes on. Man is just part of the scene. That's my thinking. Anyway, Yahuwah said in his heart, I'm not going to do this again. For man's sake, not my sake, for man's sake. But, however, even though the imagination of man's heart is bad from his youth, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Is that connected, the imaginations connected to vain imaginations in the
Upanishad? Not vain imagination. Imagination means what it means. I hadn't looked that word up in Hebrew, to be honest with you. Maybe Tammy can look that word up real quickly. But it's not imagination, the vain stuff. It means man's heart is full of bad things from his youth. Neither will I again smite evermore the things upon that I have. Yes, get over there, Tammy.
Now, the translation that I have, at least in English, the Lord says, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. So that word that my translation translates as intent,
the intent
is yetzer.
That's probably more closer to that definition. I would say it's closer to it. But
a form or framing or purpose, basically right. Intentions, you know, the framework, the handiwork of the mind.
So how does that compare to vain?
It's not the word in Hebrew, right. Vain, for word vanity is a different word in Hebrew. In that particular case, it would tell us that. But I grant you, imagine. I'll probably look more deeper into the background, the verb on it, and all that. It's an interesting question. I'll have to look into that one a little more closely. But it's like, I grant you, it probably means man's heart, his intent is to do that which is not good. What happened to Cain? It was in his heart, intent not to do good.
I would like you to elaborate on, you know, just what does that mean, you know? What does that mean?
The intent?
Yeah, I mean, like, how is it that we're given, I mean, these hearts and... I mean, I'm just wondering.
The word in here is evil, should be translated as bad. Okay? I'll give you a story that I know really took place. We had our oldest daughter. When they had their daughter, they made sure that they would never speak a lie to her, ever. And lo and behold, it was great until something happened. The daughter did something she wasn't supposed to do. I don't remember how old she was. Very young. Couple of years, 2 years, 3 years, very little. And they, well, it's not all there yet, right? No brain. And the mother saw the daughter take something was not supposed to take. And so she went and says, did you, I think it was a cookie or something. I don't remember what it was. Something like that, you know. Did you take that cookie or whatever it was? And she says, no. And it just stunned our oldest daughter. Who taught you to lie? No, it's the intent to protect oneself. The intent is, I did something bad, but I don't want anybody to know about it. So the intent to do something is within us. When we are even quarry with somebody, our intent is to put the guard on ourselves and make sure they receive the fatal blow. Instead of backing away and saying, give me the shot, give me the blow, and I'll walk. I'll turn the other cheek. Well, that's really hard. In human life, it's really hard to turn the other cheek. When someone insults you, it's really difficult to say, oh, I want to get even. Now, where the commandment says, love your neighbor as yourself, that's the book of Leviticus. And that story, it says, when your brother, not the enemy, when your brother does harm against you, you will hold no grudges. 19th chapter of Leviticus. I don't know exactly what verse it is right off hand. But in there, you will love your brother as yourself. Now, ask yourself a question. Well, I'll ask myself a question. Richard, I'm holding a grudge against Richard. I'm prejudiced against Richard. I mean, I despise Richard because Richard cheated on Richard. That doesn't make sense, does it? No, I'm in love with myself. we're not going to about accuse ourselves of something we don't want to be accused of. you understand what I'm saying? So that's why God says, hold no grudges, hold no vengeance, hold nothing against them, no matter how bad it is. John Baptist didn't come up with the idea. He read it.
How can we ever do anything but that? I mean, really.
You're right. It's like, okay, another point of intent. Another point of intent is like paying your income tax. My intent is, I don't want to pay my income tax. I'm going to pay the least amount I can. I'm going to see if I can declare this, declare that, declare this, declare that, declare this, declare that, so I pay the least amount possible. That's the intent. Well, income tax is evil. That's beside the point. The intent is, you don't want to do that. The intent is, I want nice railroads, I want nice cars, I want nice roads, and I want nice, inexpensive gas, but I don't want to make my share of it. Let somebody else do the job.
I think it's divided up into the lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and pride of life.
Yeah.
And it all falls in those three categories.
While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, it shall not cease. What will not cease? His promise. Regardless of what man does, from this point on, it will not happen again. And so what did he do? Put a rainbow to remind him, the word to mark for us. Every time you see a rainbow, that's a mark for us to remember Noah. Yes.
I've heard it said that Abba loves us so much that even if we, you know, no matter what, the fact that we're even trying is huge to him. And it somehow it falls into this thing of us having these hearts and the fact that we're fighting against this.
Right, and Book of Romans
natural
tells us,
intent
right.
of the heart.
The Book
to,
of Romans tells us two very major important things. It says that God created mankind in vain and in hope. What? I thought he created us in his image. No, he created us in vain and in hope. So our life really is empty. Oh, I don't remember where it's at. You have to look it up. But just in the Book of Romans. So we look at this point, we're starting to say, okay, what is your intent, God? Now in the Book of Numbers, over again, about four or five times, it says, oh, if there were only a heart in them. That's the book, what did I say? I meant Deuteronomy. And so now here he's saying, before Book of Deuteronomy, even though man's heart is going to do bad things from his youth, all the way until he's old, neither will smite them anymore, as I have done. As long as there is a heaven and a earth, as long as there is sun, as long as there is cold, as long as there is winter, as long as there is day, as long as there is night.
He does say, though, that he has placed a new heart in us.
Well, yeah, that's a promise coming later, but we don't see it right here in the Book of Noah right now.
Well, isn't this talking about salvation? Isn't this talking about his Holy Spirit coming and living
okay,
in us?
Let's talk about that in a minute. We talked about the dove, right? What landed and remained on the Messiah? The dove. Now, I told you before that a dove, one who brings a message from somebody else to. Now, what is it that the dove was telling John when he saw it remain? A message was coming. This is the one. This is the one. Remember, he didn't want to baptize him? And he said, no, must be fulfilled. John, God's going to show you, my Father's going to show you a message. And he's going to show you with the dove. That dove is going to show you exactly what the message is all about. It's me. Now, way back in Noah's time, God used the dove. Do you see a picture? It's a prophecy almost all by itself. When you live of and in by itself. Now, return back to your statement. Since the dove landed on the Messiah, it gives us a message that God is going to find a home for us. When that dove did not return back to Noah, the dove found a home. The dove is a picture. I have a place prepared for you. I'm going there to prepare it. I'm getting it ready for you. And when I return, you'll have a house. You'll have a home. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's just an insight, not insight, just my words. Doesn't mean too much of anything, but you know, it comes here and it says, you shall love the Lord, you shall love Yahuwah, thy Elohim, with all thy heart. What does heart mean? Labab or lavav. All it means is an enclosure. Something is enclosed within. So when you, quote, you will love Yahuwah, thy Elohim, with all thy enclosure, everything within you. Everything within you. Enclosure. Enclose God within you. Not just your feelings, but within you. That's what it means. All right. Any questions?
I found a scripture.
Okay.
Ezekiel 36:26. I will give you a new heart and put.
Oh, yeah.
Within you, and I will remove the heart of stone.
Yeah.
Ezekiel 36:26.
That's also the Hebrew word for latka.
Latka!
Lavav.
Oh, I got you.
Because that's what it, lavav, that's what the heart. Because that's what Hanukkah is all about. The dedication of that holiday is all about your heart. Hence, the name of the most symbolic food there is in it is heart.
That's fascinating. I didn't think about that. Can I borrow your pen again?
It's a funny thing how when he, at the first part when he's talking
yes.
about how awful the people are and he decides, okay, I'm going to send a flood. And then he goes to verse 21 of 8 and says, he said in his heart, he smelled the sweet aroma, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I ever again destroy living all the living things as I have done. It's almost like he was walking through a play for our benefit to see how it didn't work. Because he destroyed everybody with the rainbow. I mean, the rainbow is a symbol of it. He started over. He destroyed everybody. He started over again with Moses and all the people, and all they got in trouble. And starts over with the Ten Commandments on the mountain, and we start over in terrible, dangerous territory, and we start our walk with him again, and it still didn't work. It's almost like he was trying to make the point, there's only one thing that works, and that is for him to love us, and that we actually respond with love to him by him writing
right.
his laws on our heart. That's the only way it works.
And to let you know, I said this before, and we'll repeat it again. All right? What we're seeing is God's heart being spoken to us. You remember what it said there in the 6th chapter, verse 6? And Yahuwah said, I'm sorry. And then we see that it grieved him. He was in pain. He was in agony. He's letting us know in the 6th chapter, it's got so bad, I'm sorry I did it. And of course he found favor in Noah. Now remember, Noah was righteous. What makes righteousness? Wait. Why was Abram called a man of righteousness? Sorry, what? Ah, trusted God. That's different than saying, having faith in God. Faith is an overused English word, which means, yeah, I have faith the sun's going to rise tomorrow. Really? Yeah. Do I trust God? Well, yes, except for my health. I want to make sure I go to the doctor. Yes.
Trust. I mean, where do those two meet? You know, believe and trust, because there's so many scriptures in the New Testament about.
Okay, no, that's the New Testament one, but he'll answer that question probably for you today, maybe. Okay. But nonetheless, I can believe in a lie. Doesn't mean I trust the lie. I believe the lie. Can't I? Can I not believe a lie? Yeah, simple. So the word belief is not necessary, or I believe this, doesn't necessarily mean it's true. Doesn't mean you necessarily trust the subject matter. When trust really comes, it comes from hearing Devarim Elohim. That's the only grounds for any kind of trust. He said, trust no man. He means that, literally. Yes.
In this one translation, it says, he'll have in parentheses or square.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He says, believe. And then in those brackets, they'll say, trust in, rely on, and cling to.
Right, yeah. So it depends upon who you're talking to and what you're talking about.